on the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
In life, as Christians, we are called on to make decisions every day. Most of the time, we pray that we're making the right decisions. But sometimes, life hits us so hard and so painfully that even strong Christians get tempted to go off the reservation, so to speak, and turn to the wrong way of handling problems. We've got a serious situation in a novel that we're going to look at today called Darkness Before Dawn. The author is our longtime friend, Ace Collins. We are delighted to have him back with us today. The book is from Abingdon Press. Ace has written more than 50 books, including novels like The Christmas Star and Swoop's Ridge, a nonfiction series, Stories Behind the Best Loved Songs of Christmas. We've had a chance to talk to him about a dozen times. Actually, Ace, I think in the 20-something years I've been doing the show, I think I've probably gotten to talk to you more than any other single author. So that is really, really cool. And every book has a different texture to it and has something interesting about it. Now, lately, you've been in the fiction game, and that seems to be going pretty well for you. So I'm thinking you're going to keep doing that.
Well, and actually, the next book that comes out will actually be a nonfiction book. So I still float back and forth. I just finished a novel the other day, taking kind of a week breather, and then I'll start a nonfiction book next week. So then I go back to writing a novel again later this year and have a couple more lined up. So it really varies depending on kind of what my mood is at that time and what my agent's selling. So I want to continue to write novels.
Well,
walk away totally from the nonfiction.
Well, that's good because you're good at both. I enjoy in many ways it's the same kind of skill. It's great storytelling, whether you're telling a true story or whether you're telling a novel and trying to teach truth in that way. It still takes great narratives, right?
Well, what I am is a storyteller, and so you know, I was at a writers' conference last week, and they were asking me a lot of different questions, and the thing that I explained was that my writing style doesn't change from fiction to nonfiction. I said that when you're writing nonfiction, you're limited by the truth. When you're writing fiction, you're only limited by your imagination. But the style of writing I use is the same. It was learned at my grandfather's and grandmother's knees on the front porch of a northern Arkansas house where you listen to them tell stories. And essentially what I am is being a storyteller. I go out and I do what I do in both formats, and so there's not a difficulty I have changing from one to the other. Now, the book we have coming out this fall is a devotional book, and it's based on something that you and I have talked about in the past. In a way, I decided I wanted to write a devotional book about that's based on songs, but not hymns. I want popular music, and I want to write devotionals based on songs that everybody knows, and the key is you tell the story behind the song, you write a devotional around the Bible verse you picked out and the story behind that song, and then you end it with a charge. Mm-hmm. And it was a joy to write. I hope we get to write a bunch of them, and that will come out this fall. So it's kind of fun in that respect. And also coming out this fall is the sequel to Darkness Before Dawn, which is The Cutting Edge. And so I know we're here today to talk to Darkness Before Dawn. And it was a different style book. You mentioned early on, you kind of never know what I'm going to be writing about. Mm-hmm. In a way, from a logical standpoint, that's probably stupid of me, because everybody wants to be branded. You know, Clive Cussler, the great secular novelist, writes action adventure, and Brandon Lynn Collins, who's no relation to me, writes seatbelt suspense kind of books. You know, what I write? Well, gosh, I write a mystery, a whodunit, then I follow it with an action adventure, then I do a devotional book, and then I come out with an issues-oriented book like this. So you never know where I'm going to end up. I'd probably be a lot smarter just sticking with one style. But I have so many different interests, and so many different things inspire me and get me to thinking that I don't think you'll ever get me to settle down into one style of book.
I think that what makes this book work for me is the very scary reality that most of us, if pushed into as tight a corner as our protagonist, Meg Richards, if we were pushed into that same kind of corner that she finds herself residing, we wonder how we would react. How would we feel if we were like her, 28, just find out she's pregnant, the love of her life, what she wraps her life around, her husband, is killed in a car wreck by a drunk teenager.
Mm-hmm. And who is from a very powerful, influential, wealthy family.
Right.
That teenager is.
So he can.
And so you essentially speaking have to examine this person who's always been a Christian, didn't come to know Christ later. I mean, this is one who grew up in the church. You know, it was kind of the same way that most of us become Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly she's confronted by Christians who couldn't come her up and after this tragedy is magnified by the fact she's pregnant, and they're coming up there and saying, well, you know, something good will come out of this. What good? If you're in that situation, where can you point out, yeah, something good's going to come out of this? Or, you know, this is God's will. Well, do you really want to serve a God? This is what he does to you?
Mm.
Those are questions that I've watched people go through time and time again. I've watched them deal with well-meaning people who've come up to them with the kind of rhetoric, if you will, that's going to turn them off rather than help them. These people don't need to be given these little platitudes. They need to be listened to. They need to be heard. They need to their anger and their frustration needs to come out. And Meg is typical in the fact that everybody comes up to her and gives her all of the pat answers. But those pat answers don't work if you've ever been through that situation.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what she's going through, and yet everybody's acting like they know what she's going through. And that is very frustrating for her. The other thing I want to do in this book, we examine a lot of points. I mean, we examine DUI, we examine the inequities of the legal system, we examine abortion, we examine the roller coaster nature of faith itself. But the other thing I wanted to examine is I am not one of these who sits there and goes, gosh, we got to turn our back on Hollywood because Hollywood does so many bad things. I mean, you know, we have a choice on what we watch and what we don't want to watch, and I'm not into blaming Hollywood for anything. But
yeah.
What I will point out is there are messages that come out of entertainment where people go Rambo, and we all applaud. You know, that's become a verb here, going Rambo. And you know, you're Ramboing it, you know what I mean? But there, if you take law into your own hands, if you become you decide you want revenge and retribution, there's a tremendous cost on you. And what I really wanted to show people, as much as anything else, was the cost that revenge and retribution had on Meg Richards. It not only changed her from a person that everybody loved and adored and was very good at her job as a nurse and a wonderful daughter and a wonderful, wonderful wife, it changed her from being just the opposite of those things. But it also made her a person who lived for something that essentially turned her into something that was almost evil. And it's very easy if we get revenge and retribution and forget about forgiveness. If we focus on revenge and retribution, that's what we become. And boy, you hear it. Not only do you see it in motion pictures, but in truth. It's written about on, you know, revenge and retribution, even from Christians. You see it all the time on Facebook, on statements that are published on Facebook.
Mm.
You hear it from pulpits. You see Christians who are in not to acceptance and forgiveness, but are into revenge and retribution. And so I thought it was time that we wrote a book that honestly looked at that.
And Meg goes through all of these inner turmoils and exacerbated, like Asa said, because nobody knows what to say to her, so they all just mouth these platitudes they've heard before, which are worse than useless. It reminds me of the book of Job, when the best thing that happens at first, you really are crazy about his friends because they do the best thing. They come and they sit there for a week and they keep their mouth shut and they mourn with him. And that's the best thing we can do when people suffer any kind of loss, but especially a catastrophic loss like this, to go up to them and say, this is God's will, and he's got a place for your loved one in heaven, or he needed another rose or another angel, or all of that nonsense, that isn't help at all. It's worse than useless because, it says, just like Asa said, it tells them, what you're suffering is no big deal. Get over it. Move on. Or, well, we just knew we had to say something, so here's something we're saying.
And I think that's the whole thing. I've actually had several people who've sent me emails already, and two of them have been nationally known reviewers who sent me emails that said, I will never go into another situation and use those 15 different things that I normally say because I realize now how worthless those things are.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, hey, if they got that out of this book, then that's a start. You know, and we painted Meg, and boy, Meg is off the deep end. You start thinking about the things that Meg feels. But realize, when you're looking at somebody like Meg, when you're looking at somebody who is 28 years old, has the love of their life, they're about to look at houses, they're about to have a baby, all of this stuff is happening, you know, and there's a line, and as writers, you don't realize when you write lines that have real meaning. As a matter of fact, you don't remember the lines. You actually have people that come back later and tell you the lines, and you're going, oh, wow, was that in that book? You know, you get people who actually give you those lines back, and they say, boy, this line really hit where I was when I lost my husband. But the quote was, for Steve, there would be no Monday. Let me start it again. For Steve, there would be no Monday. Time had stopped, and her husband had been lost somewhere between the seconds. When you realize this is what this woman's going through, everything was on the table. Everything was being planned. Their anniversary was about to happen, and then somewhere between the seconds, he died. And he didn't die being a hero. He didn't die going through something that helped other people. He died senselessly because a teenager got drunk. And then you walk up and you say, well, that was God's will. I don't think God wanted that teenager to get drunk and kill Steve. I don't think that person needs to hear that. Now, can good come out of this? Obviously, in this book, it does. You know, we're not going to leave you in the darkness forever. There is a dawn. And we also have a spiritual anchor. And the uniqueness of our spiritual anchor in this book, in Nancy, Nancy's a young woman who's dying of cancer.
Yeah.
And yet Nancy is the spiritual anchor for Meg when all of the people who should be spiritual anchors are not. And Nancy is, because Nancy is able to, through her life trials, actually say things to Meg that make an impact, make her think. And therefore, it's the irony of a person whose days are counted, whose time on earth are counted in days, being the person who teaches someone else how not to be bitter, someone else how to live. You know, there's a unique relationship there that I think speaks volumes about what life is all about and how life is this moment and it's this second, and we've got to make the most of it. And so, you know, there's the other thing that we tried to teach through this whole thing. I jokingly say that if Oprah still had her daily show, this book has five different Oprah shows in one book,
you know,
with all the different things we talk about. But it's very value-oriented. And therefore, we go after, we intensely look at those values, and we'll intensely look at the price of what DUI. Hey, DUI still takes between 10 to 20,000 people a year. Injures another 200,000 or 300,000. Boy, that's a lot of folks. I mean, that senselessly die because somebody gets drunk and gets behind the wheel. And we still do not look at it as seriously as we should in this country. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we need to address and we need to look at. I had a reviewer that told me, or that said in his review, a national reviewer that said every teenager in the United States should read this book. And I thought, well, that's a nice comment because... And he wasn't reading it as a somebody who was a Christian. He was just reading it as a secular book reviewer. And he said, every teenager in the country should read this book to know the cost of what they do. And I thought, boy, that's nice to know that we drove the point home.
Well, one of the things that makes him an interesting character is that up to the point of this accident, he has really been a self-centered little jerk.
Yeah.
This changes him. And he didn't expect that. None of his friends understand why he's not particularly interested in partying anymore. I think even before Meg starts going Rambo on him, he's already starting to have serious doubts about the choices that he's made. When he realizes how he has destroyed her life and turned her from the woman that everybody liked into a maniac, then he figures that he really is a monster and that there's no saving him.
Oh, and we also look at this kid, too. This is a kid who's had everything, cars, boats, vacations, lives in a huge mansion. But the one thing he hasn't had is love. His parents have given him everything except themselves.
Right, the one thing they need.
Yeah. They've been too busy wrapped up in their own world to give them themselves. And so in that respect, we also see the ramifications of just turning a teenager loose without giving a teenager the one thing they really want, which is love, acceptance, and having you proud of them for the right reasons. And so, yeah, he's a tragic figure in a way. The irony being, and you just kind of hit it, the irony being is you've got somebody you really care for in the first few chapters, and that's Meg, and somebody you really dislike, and that's Jim. and in the context of the next 200 pages, that flip-flops. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, as much as you want to, gosh, wrap your arms around Meg, Meg's become kind of an early, ugly person, and then as much as you wanted Jim to get his comeuppance, you know, by that point in the book, you're feeling sorry for him.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a couple of tragic figures in this book, and they're both impacted by what happened on that highway that night. And by the way, somebody asked me, why did you want to write this book? My best friend was killed by a drunk driver in high school. So, I mean, I was a hit-and-run drunk driver, and I wanted to basically, I watched what his family went through, and they were wonderful people, and they survived, and they got their life back on track. But that wound never totally healed. The missing the child that died needlessly never healed. And so it becomes important for us to address that, even in an entertainment sense, like Darkness Before Dawn does.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, Ace Collins is joining us again today, which is really a great treat. His new book is Darkness Before Dawn from Abington Press. You can find out more about Ace by checking his website, acecollins.com. Become his fan on Facebook at ace.collins or follow him on Twitter at acecollins. You can also check out abingtonpress.com. His recent novel, The Christmas Star, we had a chance to talk to Ace for this past Christmas to talk about that book. And we've had many chances through the years to visit with him, talking about his nonfiction books and most recently about fiction books. He's got a new nonfiction book that's coming up. And he's got over 60 titles, and he's been writing for 2.5 decades. And
yeah,
from thrillers and sweet books like the Yellow Packard, which is just a lovely, lovely book. Ace gave me the great privilege of getting to be an advanced reviewer on that, so that actually the pre-publicity that went out included some things that I said about the book, which is a great
thrill. Yeah, that book is still out there and still hot, so people can go get that book. And
it's a great story.
Yeah, that's a triple twist ending in that book, and that was a whole lot of fun for me to write. I mean, I had, that was a trip in itself. And at the end of the book, I actually cried writing the ending of that book. And that's not sad tears, that's happy tears. I mean, I actually got to the point in the last twist ending where I only time out of the more than 70 books I've written, that's the only time I've ever cried while writing something. And I actually cried while writing it because I'd gotten so involved in the Packard, which was a whodunit. I mean, the Packard was a whodunit. But all of my books, all of my fiction books, whether they're secular or Christian, and realize this, I'm not a Christian writer, I'm a Christian who writes. And so if you read a secular book of mine, like Rite of Passage, you're not going to have any cussing, you're not going to have any sex. It's going to read just like my Christian books do, and you're also going to find the subtle little Christian message underlying the whole thing, even if it's for the secular world. I mean, you know, I am who I am, and I can't stop that, so I'm going to write that into whatever book I've got. And so I don't make a conscious effort to write a book differently because it's secular than I do if it's Christian. I just write them. And I have a goal, and you've read a lot of my stuff, and you probably recognize it. My goal is to not write a book that is only sold in Christian bookstores.
Right.
My goal is not to write a book that's only read by the people who read Christian fiction. I want to write a book that is so good, even if it's Christian fiction, that people in the secular world pick it up and read it.
Right. Because otherwise, you're just in kind of a Christian ghetto. And
exactly.
it's that sanctuary mentality. We're going to pull the walls around us and protect ourselves as long as we can keep the bad guys out. And that's not what we're supposed to do as Christians. We're not supposed to watch the fish in the aquarium. We're supposed to go out there and fish for men and women for the kingdom.
Yeah, in my terminology, I don't want to write for the choir. So
there you go.
I want to actually write for the folks who may never pick up a Christian novel and say, what is, hey, let me open my Bible up and take a look at this little thing he's tossed in here. That's interesting. And examine their own life and find out if some of my characters, and all my characters, getting back to what I was telling you, all of my characters, including Meg in a way, are looking for callings.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to find out who they are and how they fit in. They're not characters who have all the answers. They're struggling with the answers. They're struggling with their doubts. They're struggling with their fears. I think they're real people. I don't want to write about, I don't want to have a hero that is so heroic that you can't relate to him or her. I want you to be able to relate to my characters as people you know, or maybe even yourself. want you to think about yourself getting put in Meg's place and going, well, I hope it wouldn't rank this way, but, you know, I might. And then I want you to look at the fact of what it did to her so that maybe you won't go her route. Because there's an awful lot of us who, in truth, deep down inside, really would like somebody who hurt us to get theirs. Mm-hmm. And we're not into forgiving. We really want them to suffer like we did. And I want to show that the ultimate goal was to show the cost of that suffering. And the great thing about it is we got to grow Meg up in this book, and Meg is the spiritual anchor in the cutting edge that comes out this fall.
Ah.
And so Meg moves in this series from being the focal point to now being the background character who will be the spiritual anchor. The Nancy in our book is the spiritual anchor in this book. Well, Meg moves on to being the spiritual anchor in the next books in this series. And so therefore we continue to get to look at issues, but we get to find out somebody who grew into that anchor role, just like you and I can,
right,
when we go through tragedies as well.
Well,
yeah.
Essentially, that's the way to create great characters, is not to have someone who's the same at the end of the book as they were at the beginning, because people aren't like that in real life. So you want people in your books who are changed by the experiences that they have. And I know plenty of people who have lost children who were in their teens that were in cars, or who were young adults and something happened to them. And sometimes it's an accident. Sometimes it's an unexpected illness that suddenly takes them.
Mm-hmm.
And these are staunch Christians, and it's still a struggle for them. It's still a painful loss. And they're not going to pop up that day and say, well, I know this is God's will, so I'm going to hang in there and wait for him to reveal this to me. Because nobody wants to think of God as this executioner style who's going to kill your child in order to make a point. But like you do with Evelyn and with Jim, God redeems the pain. God redeems the suffering. And even with Nancy, she didn't want to get cancer, but cancer doesn't define her. Instead, cancer allows God to refine her.
Exactly. And that's the goal all of us have. Very few of us are going to skate through life without tragedies. Every year at this time, because, you know, we're coming up on D-Day again, mm-hmm. I think about the tremendous loss and sacrifice of World War II, of all of those men who didn't come home.
Right.
And think about the tragic loss for the nation of having that many hundreds of thousands of young men who might have changed the world not come home. Think about the hundreds of thousands of people who lost those loved ones and the hole that left in their lives. And so when you think about it in those numbers, it means nothing. But when you actually paint it into one person, and we did in Meg's case, we painted this tragedy into one person. Her husband is killed by a drunk driver. Well, gosh, suddenly you feel it. You know, it's not some statistic out there that says 14,544 people were killed last year by drunk drivers. No, it's real. This is a person. And I think that gives us an opportunity. And here we have a person who had their faith and lost their faith, and how they find it back. Here we have the person who's decided, you know, we keep using the term going Rambo, which we celebrate in movies, and here's the person who's done that, and suddenly you realize it's not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something to cheer about. It's ugly when somebody does that.
Yeah, and it's a hollow victory.
It's a hollow victory for her. As a matter of fact, when she finally gets what she prays for, she didn't want it. It makes her feel dirty.
Yeah.
And that's, and that's when the ultimate mirror is held up to her face. And I think, you know, in the end, does she understand why her husband was taken from her? No. But she's ready to move forward, and she's ready to help, and she's ready to do something with that tragedy to prevent it from happening to somebody else, and somebody else doesn't have to go through that. And I think that's the ultimate goal that we all have. We're not going to fully understand it. We don't have the capabilities in our finite minds of understanding an infinite God. And we don't understand, in a sense, why things happen. But we live in a sinful world, and people are going to make wrong choices, and wrong choices ultimately spill out and hurt people who are innocent people. And that is another thing to look at that this book teaches. You have to be very careful about the choices you make, because those choices you make may not affect you, but they may affect somebody else in a way that none of us can fathom.
I keep going back to the relative age, too, of the teenager, Jim Thomas, and his victim. Only about 10, 11 years separate the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it just keeps saying to me that 10 years later, he's going to remember that he has gotten to age to the age of the man he killed. And no matter how much he regrets it, he can't change that fact. And that guy will never get a day older because of him.
That guy's lost between the seconds, as we said in the book.
Yeah.
And that is the ramifications of doing one thing wrong, ultimately speaking, can cost someone else their lives. I lead a home group every Sunday night during the school year with about 40 college kids, and we feed them, and then we do devotionals. And the thing that I try to teach all the time, because these kids who come in here are Christians, but I try to put that Christian faith into action and make them realize that people look at them. And you're going to make mistakes in life, but you need to realize there are always people watching you to slip up. There's people watching, and so you're affecting people. It's a ripple in the stream or ripple in the pond kind of thing. And I think that's, you know, Meg is out to get Jim, and that's the only person she thinks she's affecting. But she's affecting so many people other than Jim. And that's, there's a part early in the book where she's watching an old tomcat from across the street kill a cardinal, in her front yard. And I think that foreshadows to a certain degree what happens in the book. And it also foreshadows the depth of Meg's pain. And therefore, you know, gosh, flip side of that, what would have happened to Meg if there hadn't been a Nancy? And by the way, Nancy's one of two characters that I've written about in my entire life in novels that is based on a real character. There was a real Nancy in my life who died of cancer at 33 years old.
Wow.
And the quotes that people read in this book that this Nancy says, there's about 15 quotes that Nancy directly gave me when she was battling cancer. So I'm actually quoting the real Nancy throughout this book. So the spiritual mentor to Meg is really based on a person who gave me all of those answers 20 years ago.
Wow. Well, that's an awesome tribute to your friend, and also an indication of the timelessness, the truth that's to be found in the Christian faith.
Well, the interesting thing that Nancy said in this book, and it's something that our listeners need to hear about, when Meg says, don't you ever, because Nancy had battled cancer three times, and this is an exact quote from Nancy herself, because I asked Nancy this question, don't you ever say, why me? And the real Nancy, as well as the Nancy in the book, answers it this way. No, I say, why not me? Because I would rather be battling cancer and have this happen to me than have it happen to somebody I love. And boy, that is when you know you have your faith together, when you've hit a point where you recognize you don't want this. But you'd rather have this than have your son have it, or your mother have it, or your sister have it, or have your wife have it, or have your best friend have it. You know, that's when you fully have understood, I think, what grace is all about, what courage is all about, and what carrying the cross is all about.
Our friend Ace Collins back with us again, talking about his new book, Darkness Before Dawn, from Abington Press. It's an amazing read, and it really is the kind of book that every teenager who has ever thought about, wouldn't it be fun to go to a party and get snockered, you need to read this book first. This should be passed out by chapters of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Students Against Destructive Decisions. It is that powerful. A great read. And thank you again, Ace, as always, for making time to be with us here on the bookshelf.
And there's no place I enjoy being any more than with you, Doc, and what a pleasure it has been to be back with you on this day as well.
Our thanks once again to my friend Ace Collins for joining us again today on the bookshelf. His new book is Darkness Before Dawn from Abington Press. Look for it at acecollins.com or abington.com or at your favorite bookstore and online everywhere. We'll see you next time on your favorite radio station for On the Bookshelf. Until then, I'm your host, Doc Kirby. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless.